So, good evening. We are here for a talk tonight. We'll talk a little bit about virtue. Last month we talked about generosity, so we can have that kind of energy that says, oh, that's gone. Now we'll move on to something new. But actually, virtue is an extension of generosity. These paramis, I think I've said before, a lot of the lists in Buddhist practice, they don't say that you practice them sequentially. You know, you just sort of practice whatever on the list. But it seems like every teacher that talks about the paramis say that we practice the paramis in a sequential understanding. It's sort of an unfolding of understanding around these paramis to sort of help us step into each one. So a way to think about it would be that virtue, we're going to talk about over the course of February, but generosity that comes from virtuous intentions is far more beneficial. It's far more fruitful and supportive than just giving, but you don't really have good intention in your giving. So that you could give, but when that giving is connected to a virtuous heart, then the giving itself becomes more beneficial. Receiving from a virtuous heart, a sense of appreciation, that then receiving also has a greater effect on continuing that gift off into the future in a beneficial way. So even though we're not talking about generosity per se, you could also think that if you didn't have this kind of generous, abundant spirit trying to practice into virtue the way we're going to sort of explore this over the month, you can see where virtue can get a little heartened. It can get a little self-righteous, I guess would be a good word, or judgmental. And so part of the underbelly, the foundation of virtue, comes from having already practiced in a way that we're opening the heart in this greater sense of abundance. And we're dropping our virtuous conduct down in that open heart and having an effect on the world that way. Another way you could think about virtue is that we're not really practicing with the Eightfold Path, right? We're practicing with the paramis. But I think you'll find that the practicing of with the paramis kind of go hand in hand with this Eightfold Path that Buddha laid out, these eight sort of factors that you can begin to practice around and cultivate that kind of line us up into this much more greater capacity to liberate the mind. So generosity, so the Eightfold Path can be divided up into three things: wisdom, conduct, and then meditative stability. So you work on your wisdom, you work on your conduct, and you work on this kind of meditative stability, and it's divided up into eight. That conduct aspect is generosity, this month, virtue, and next month when Tim talks about renunciation. The three of those together is what is pointing to towards conduct. So even though we're talking about these qualities from the perspective of the paramis, this kind of more open, enlightened way of practicing, we're actually stepping out there on the path and looking for that liberation in our own right. So next month, in the second half of the month, the last 2 weeks, I want to talk about the actual conduct, the right speech, right action, precepts and right livelihood as part of the Eightfold Path. But before we do that, I really like to talk about what is the nature of virtue. Because understanding, the more I read up on this and the more I kind of contemplate it and try to feel into it, the more I am understanding that some of the way we use that word virtue can be quite limiting, much more limiting than I think the practice is expected to be. So it's the term is sila in Pali. And I don't really, I mean, I have a hard enough time pronouncing some of the Pali words, but trying to understand the definition of them, it's even harder. But I never trust the English translation of Pali words, because English can be a bit of, you know, rigid, has some rigidity to it that Pali seems much more fluid and open. So I looked up this word virtue in Webster, so I could see, okay, this is what we when we speak in virtue, there's kind of a definition that we're operating from. It says morally good conduct or good, morally good behavior or character, parentheses here, kind of conformity to a standard of right. So we kind of understand a rightness. Second aspect of it would be a good and moral quality. And the third is the good result that comes from something, like a beneficial quality or the power in a thing. So if you listen to that, right, this kind of conformity to a standard of right, who exactly is going to decide what that right is? Because I can just tell just from where I am in my life right now that we would have a hard time all agreeing on what exactly is right and what is wrong. So there's this kind of idea in the English version of morality, ethical conduct, virtue, that there's some right out there, some right that we all should know and we should all be following along. And if you're not following along in that right, then there's something wrong with you. But just take a moment and think about all the moral judgments you have about other people's behavior. And most of that moral judgment only comes because you don't do that behavior. If you did it, you know, it'd probably be a little bit okay. You know, it gets a little fuzzy when we do it. So you can hear in our English version that there's kind of a definitiveness, a thingness to virtue. Virtue is this. This is what it is. We all kind of agree. I remember one time you know, I was talking to some friends and I made this comment. I guess the comment didn't sound like what normal black people say, whatever that normal is. I don't know why we all have our own, we're all lumped up here, but I made this comment. It was totally in line with what I thought. I'll probably give you a little bit more detail. So I said, walking with my friend, and I said, I wish African Americans would be a little bit more aware about our behavior and how it affects the overall earth ecology. I wish we would pay more attention to how we affect the climate and, you know, these ecosystems. I was beginning to be more and more aware myself, and I thought, I wish this was much more of a normal part of being African American. So my friend, who's white, said, well, okay, Tori, they probably would be if they didn't have to worry so much about survival. And I thought, survival? She's like, you know, you're middle class. You don't understand what it's like to be African American and have to survive. You hear what I'm saying? She had this judgment that somehow or another, that if, that there's like the, I guess, the middle class African Americans and the non-middle class African Americans, I don't know, but her sense was that this is the way African Americans think. And my making this comment somehow or another was outside of that. So I clearly don't understand. But in this practice in Buddhism, it's a little different. It is a fluid practice. It's always moving. It's always changing. What may be real today, feel very solid today, is completely wrong tomorrow, doesn't feel right, something's not quite lining up. There's a sense of fluidity in everything we do. Even when we say our precepts are, we're undertaking the training to do whatever. There's always this sense that there's this forever shifting, changing, learning, opening, wisdom, more and more, closing, open. So that fluidity has, it means that all this phenomena around virtue in the practice is conditioned. It is based on some conditions that come together. All phenomena is based on condition, including our ethical conduct is based on some conditioning. So Buddha said, these are the last kind of words they said that Buddha gave to his monastics. He said, "Behold, O monks, this is my last advice to you. All component things in the world are changeable. They are not lasting. Work hard to gain your own salvation." So even though I'm going to give you a talk on virtue, I'm going to give you a talk on virtue from my perspective of having spent this practice around virtue. But everybody in this room will need to look into your own life, your own conduct, your own practice in relation to your conduct, and feel into that virtue for yourself. It is why we start with generosity, so you can open up your heart, open up to the sense of abundance, and then you can begin to drop your conduct in it and begin to investigate it with a much deeper eye, rather than just listening to what I say about virtue and then say, oh, that's what virtue is. Because some of what I say tonight, you may say, oh, I don't know if I agree with that. And you'll have to check for yourself and see where your heart, your sense of understanding lines up with mine or with the practice. So the first kind of condition, that's what we want to do. Look, see if we can look for the conditions that give rise to sila. What gives rise to sila showing up? What conditioned behavior do we need to set as a floor in order that we can be more, I guess, comfortable in seeing that virtue would arise? And the first one is this word chastity. It's a condition that gives rise to the presence of sila. I was a little shocked because I only think chastity has to do with sex. I didn't ever really think of chastity as having to do with anything else. Maybe you just don't have sex and so that would make you chaste. But I looked it up just to make sure. And there is a couple of more ways that chastity is used. One is in this kind of purity of conduct and intention, but also in restraint and simplicity in design and expression. kind of a simplicity in the way that we express ourselves and in our personal integrity. So this chastity as a condition to me is pointing to this sense of our own personal integrity. For me, because I practiced with nonviolent communication for many, many years, it's sort of practicing out of your own values. It's knowing what's actually arising for you in any given moment and acting with integrity around your own personal value. Sort of like looking at the motivation and assumptions that are behind our behavior. How much greed or hatred, you know, aversion or delusion are we trying to, you know, is there something else going on? So I'll give you an example. Some of you might know this. Two examples. One, when I started doing nonviolent communication, so you know I'm a prosecutor, was prosecutor for 25 years, but I learned nonviolent communication from two guys who had went to prison, and they had spent a good 70 years of their life in prison. And at one point, I found out that one of the guys that was going to teach me this nonviolent communication, you know, I met them and I just liked the way they were. They seemed so together, so solid in themselves. And so I wanted to learn this thing, and they were the ones that were going to teach me. But then I found out what one of the crimes was that one of these people committed. And I got a problem, because I got a judgment about that crime. Big judgment. And I don't want to be around this person because they're not good. That's why they commit that crime. They're not good. So I don't want to be around them. And I certainly don't want to go in their house, which is where we were going to learn this nonviolent communication. And I will never forget this life-changing moment I had. We all have life-changing moments. You got to lock them down and nail it down right then and there. I'm not going to forget this. So I was sitting in my car, vacillating between going in the house with someone that I could not even fathom could be of any value, not on my level. And this love I had for this person and wanting to know, how do I connect with that open-hearted way of living? So I got all my judgment, I got all this wanting to like know this, I love this. And back and forth, I argued with myself about whether I should go in that house. And my heart won. I went in the house. And when I got in the house, he gave me this look like, you sure you want to be here? Don't ask me, it's been difficult. So I just told him, I'm really scared. I don't feel safe, and I'm not quite sure what I should do. I want to do this, but I just don't feel safe. And we came up with an agreement that we would leave the door open to his apartment, and I would sit right next to it. So if I needed to do a mad dash, I'm good. And after a while, I closed the door and then moved on into the circle with everybody else. And it's like this gradual, he let me have the space, and I was true to myself about what was really going on, not pretending. Fast forward a few years, now I'm teaching NVC in prisons. He's like opened the door for me, him and the two guys that were there, they opened the door for me to, it's this, even the idea of a prosecutor going into prison, teaching nonviolent communication, all of this was just unthinkable. So then I had this moment where he got in trouble and he got arrested, and someone asked me to check and see if this was going to be a third strike and he was going to have to do a life sentence. So I asked a cop friend of mine to check and tell me. And when this cop looked at my friend's history, they looked at me and they were like, "You know this guy? This is a friend? Who's this? Are you kidding me?" Like, there's like a code of conduct here. We're kind of all intertwined. There's a community. And we all kind of trust each other. And there's a standard that we all live by and kind of hold. It's not that I'm saying that prosecutors or cops, some people think they're all bad, but I mean, there's a quality of care that we look after each other. And here I am totally 100% violating that because this guy's history is pretty bad. I didn't even know the guy's history. It is pretty bad. And I remember feeling this sense of, again, wanting to hit the door and run out and say, "I don't know that guy. No, no, no. He's not a friend of mine. No, 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 no. You got it all wrong. It's not like that." But instead, I said, "I don't know that person. But the person I know, he's my friend. I don't know who this guy is. And the two might have to be reconciled. But yeah, this is my friend, the person I know." And I think that cop stood there staring at me and just no. But then they left and they said, "You know, Tori, you're a better person than I." I would have judged it, wrote it off, and that would have been the end of it. So to me, this chastity is more about looking at your own values, paying attention to your values and how your values are showing up. It's those little tiny moments when we just skip right over the value. We just skip right over our own internal integrity so we can get along. Everybody likes us and we feel like we're part of the crowd. We don't want to pop our head up. But sometimes we have to pop our head up a little bit. In fact, it seems like this chastity is where we create this relationship with me, myself, and I. You know, we always say non-self, non-self, non-self. But inside of us, there's a core. There's something that gets triggered. And we know when we're sliding around the boundary lines. We feel it in the body, a sense of, I'm like pushing over, letting something slide. Someone's looking at me saying, "Do you believe that?" And, you know, you can feel it. You could easily just say, "Oh, no, 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 I don't believe that." But there, you lose something there. Pema Chodron said, "Wholeheartedness is a precious gift, but no one can actually give it to you. You have to find the path that has heart and then walk it impeccably. It's like someone laughing in your ear, challenging you to figure out what to do when you don't know what to do. It humbles you and it opens your heart." That's sort of what this chastity is around virtue. It's like watching our conduct. So for a long time, I looked outside of myself to blame people for conduct. Looked everywhere else to blame people. And now it's not like I don't blame people, but when I start feeling that internal tension, no one knows I'm feeling it except for me, and I know when I start feeling it, I know it's time for me to turn inward and check out what's going on. When I start feeling a bit of an edge there, it's time for me to come inward to find some kind of liberation from it. And so I think this practice around chastity is how we begin to feel the freedom of blamelessness. There's a sense of freedom that comes with blamelessness that we don't often get to feel it because we live out of worlds of judgment. And this is sort of a way that even though there's a bit of an edge, there's a blamelessness that comes with standing up for your own values. Not someone else's values, not the values your family says you should have, not the value teachers say you should have, but the value you actually experience in a given moment. Which leads to the second one here. The second one is calmness, is a condition that gives rise to sila. For a long time in my practice, in the early sense, I thought of calmness as being peaceful, happy, kind of, a sense of cohesiveness, you know, everything's going good, everything's happening right, that's why I'm calm. If things were going bad, I wouldn't be calm. So sort of like this a sense that the machine was working, going good, traveling along. I don't really think that way anymore. I think of calmness more as a balance between two extremes. I want something or I don't want something. I want something, I don't have it. Or I don't want something and I have it. Sort of this balance in between those two extremes, and I'm standing in the middle. Holding them both. The reason why things begin to turn from my original belief that calmness was about things going good, things being peaceful, I'm calm because it's peaceful, is because I kept trying to practice being calm with all this mess all around me. So I'm in the prosecutor's office. There's a lot of harm that people do out there. There's a lot of meanness. I'm black, so there's a lot of racism, discrimination. There's all this stuff that goes on all around us all the time. I gotta live with this. And I kept thinking that the practice was gonna somehow or another make me calm about it. Just be peaceful. It's okay. Peaceful. It's all good. That doesn't work. I kept having these explosive moments, getting angry, not liking things, not accepting this. I just can't even fathom it. So I thought, okay, maybe I should begin to shift. And instead of thinking that calmness was related to things being peaceful, it was when I could just accept things as they truly are. We say that all the time. I'm just going to accept something as it is. So I tried that. I tried moving into this, just accepting it. I don't like it, but I'm just going to accept it. And it would always push up against this idea that there are just some things I cannot accept. I want to push on it. I don't want it. I mean, okay, it's there, but I don't want it. You can see, even in that kind of trying to accept things and wanting to push against it because I don't like it, there's no calmness there. There's no calm. So I'm telling you how I found calmness in conduct. But how you find calmness may be completely different. But calmness is the condition that gives rise, one of four conditions that give rise to the sila. The way I found this calmness was I stopped sort of rejecting the fact that I wanted to change things. There's a sense that I had to learn to hold this balance between the part of me that did not like something, which I could feel it in the body, and the part of me that either could not change it or wanted to change it. All of that energy, just stand there and hold both of them. And the accepting became more of this balanced capacity to accept that there are things that I wish I could change and I want to change, and it's accepting it all. This in the middle, accepting whatever's arising. And I can find now that even in the midst of some intense anger or fear or grief, I can feel the calmness. Even though I know there's all this whirlwind going on inside the body, there's a calmness that's there that's not born out of the conditions are fixed, but it's born out of learning to find my way towards that calmness. I found my own way to that condition of calmness. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, said that everyone tries to remove superficial pain, but there's another class of techniques concerned with removing suffering on a deeper level, aiming at a minimum to diminish suffering in future lives, and beyond that, even remove all forms of suffering for oneself as well as all other beings. Spiritual practice is this deeper type. These techniques involved an adjustment of attitude. The spiritual practice basically means you adjust your thoughts as well. I mean, you adjust your thought well. In Sanskrit, it's called dharma, which means that which holds. So in some respects, that's sort of what we're doing here in this practice of cultivating calmness in our conduct, is that some of your conduct you aren't going to like. Some of your conduct, you're going to feel it, and there's going to be like, oh, I can't believe I keep doing that. And there is a sense of being calm in that. To shift your attitude from somehow or another having to try to find some right way to be, and shift it instead in standing in a place that allows you to be calm and see into what's going on in conduct. Third way is quiet. It's a third condition. So we have this chastity, a sense of calmness and quiet. And for many of you, calmness, quiet, that sounds like, oh, that's the same thing. But actually, when you start practicing with it, it's very different. When I think of quiet, I think of our noble silence, our cultivating solitude. As I started practicing more and more and more, and avoiding certain negative things, negative places, negative environments, it's quite strange because in my little apartment, I have all these things that are, every time my eye looks, even if I'm not even paying attention, if my eye looks, it's going to see some good quality on the wall. It's going to see something. I mean, I've been in that apartment so long, I don't even see half the stuff on the wall. But the eye sees it. And I know there's a sense that it's always seeing and constantly being reminded of this pointing towards solitude. So when we start avoiding all of these negative energies, not even negative places, thinking of just where you go, but negative places in the mind, when we have these habitual patterns of always, you know, judging, thinking, whining, complaining, it's habitual. And I would begin to see that, and I would avoid these negative places. What I would tell myself, I would hear my mind complaining, because I live on the edge of always averse, and so I would hear the mind complaining, and I'm like, oh, We're avoiding negative places. Avoiding negative places. At the same time, you are sort of letting the distractions kind of fall away. Cultivating this idea that you're not letting distractions constantly get in the way. I think that's why retreats are so stark, have this noble silence. You're actually cultivating what it's like to allow virtuous activity to arise, virtuous conduct to arise. You're actually cultivating solitude and this quietness. And we have a tendency to think that we have to go to a retreat in order to get that. But as many retreats as I've been on, what I realize is it's not so much of what happens when I'm at the retreat, but it is how I bring that retreat kind of aspect into my life. Do I pay attention to the amount of negativity that's just around me? Do I pay attention to how much distractions are around me? I'm basically cultivating solitude. Give myself some time so I can practice in this much more quieter place. And then gradually, when we do this, gradually, you just begin to see things. I can see habits so clearly that I couldn't see before. Not because all of a sudden I am so focused on my habit, but when you just, regardless of your conduct, begin to clear away some of the distraction and begin to pay attention to the amount of negativity that's showing up all around you, this capacity to see into our habitual minds, to understand the wisdom of the Dhamma, to understand how generosity relates to virtue, these understandings, these insights, they just arise because we're cultivating that, the ground, making it fertile so it can. The last, wait a minute, I have my quote for this section. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh, says, the day has now ended, our lives are shorter. Now we look carefully. What have we done? Noble Sangha, with all our heart, let us be diligent, engaging in the practice. Let us live deeply free from affliction, aware of impermanence, so life does not drift away without meaning. In some respects, the reason why I put that here is because you almost need a bit of solitude to appreciate impermanence. I can understand impermanence and dukkha and anatta when I'm at a retreat far better than I can understand when I'm walking around in everyday life. So you almost need to cultivate that kind of retreat, noble silence, solitude in your everyday life, so you can begin to see into the beauty of what this practice is all about. All of us in our own practice, in our own lives, cultivating this sense of retreat world, even in our own world. I have a friend, I think he still does it, but every December, he actually sets up his own month-long retreat. And so he just cooks all this food and stacks it all up in the freezer, and he does this little sitting and walking and listening to his Dhamma talk at 7 o'clock. I mean, it just sounds so precious to me that he would set up all this time. But he says that it's more almost enjoyable to get everything ready than going on a retreat and doing it somewhere else. There's something about the sacredness of bringing that solitude from retreat into our everyday life. So the final condition that leads to the arising of sila is this extinguishment. And I thought to myself, extinguishment? I guess that would be like putting out the fire, turning off the noise, so that's like quiet. But actually, extinguishment is something that I feel is something very different. We talked a lot in generosity around letting go, and this, and generosity helping support us in letting go. And that is what I think this extinguishment is. It is the virtue version of letting go. So the more I kind of looked into it, I think of it as, think of all the judgment you have around all your conduct. Especially when we step into this practice, if you are anything like me, you had in your mind, and probably still have, an image of what a good Buddha is. Good yogi, good Buddha, good practitioner. And that's what you're aiming for. So every time you step outside of that image, all this judgment comes up. Shame and blame and, oh, I'll never get this. And all of this sort of unnecessary pressure that we put on ourselves, as if somehow or another that beating ourselves up is going to make us get better the next time. I'd say the best instructions Rodney ever gave me was when I went in there to talk about the big A, the big anger. I have so much anger. I need to deal with it. It's enough already. I can barely, you know, I'm always screaming at people and I don't want to do it anymore. So I go into Rodney and I'm like, Rodney, I got to work on this anger. I mean, I got everything else down pat, but the anger is just, it's blowing everything. Because I could be good. Messing up everything. So I wanted him to tell me, how do I stop being angry? And he said, well, practice with your irritations. Start looking for those. Don't worry about the anger. I'm like, well, is that going to make the anger go away? And he goes, Tuari. I said, don't worry about the anger. Practice your irritations. I'm like, okay, but maybe I didn't make myself clear. I really came in to work on the anger. I don't really get irritated. He started laughing at me. I said, I don't really get irritated. I get angry. He's like, Tuari, you keep trying to look at the response and not the place where the body is trying to tell you over and over and over, something's happening here, something's wrong here, something's here. This is your practice right here. Not in the ultimate, you know, reactivity. By the time you get to the reactivity, damage is already done. You go back here, you back it up a little bit before any damage has even happened, and you work on that. So, you know, I love Rodney, so I do whatever he says, even though I'm like walking out of the house saying, yeah, he didn't really get it. I should have said it differently. I would have worked on it differently. But I started looking for irritation, even though I truly expected I'm not going to find any. Because I'm not irritated. I'm angry. You guys know. You know I had it backwards. Oh, my God. I was irritated about everything. It was so embarrassing how irritated I was. I was irritated about everything. I didn't like anything. And I began to notice just how much the mind was grumbling and complaining. I was stunned. So if you have all this judgment around it, you're stirring the pot. You're stirring up the soup. It's going to get worse. No wonder I had so much anger, because I had to do so much energy to keep from seeing that, you know, I'm exploding on everybody. So somehow you have to have this capacity to hold this thing that you've been avoiding for years, hold it and watch it and trust. Don't worry about the anger. Trust that it has an effect on that anger. It did. It's not that I don't blow up, because I have family members that will say, yeah, she didn't do nothing to work on her anger. I don't want to have you thinking I don't blow up, or I don't have this, I get angry. It's probably anger is one of those things that's with you all the time. It's not the anger anymore, though. I do not lose myself like I used to lose myself. I don't like black out and then wish I had never said all that stuff. I have the capacity to square up my conduct by myself. I don't need someone to tell me how to be. I don't need somebody to set the standard for me. There's an internal sense I know when I'm moving astray. I know when I'm moving outside of the boundary lines. I can feel it, and I know for myself. I apologize to people, and sometimes people don't even know. They're like, oh, I didn't even know. Like, I knew. I know what's going on here. That sense of having to get all the way to the edge doesn't happen so much so anymore. So we need this ability to extinguish all that judgment, all that crap we unload on ourselves all the time. All that criticism about unskillful behavior, and kind of let our unskillful behavior actually show us where good, right conduct falls, where it falls. Because when you feel that something is wrong, something you don't like about something you're doing, something's out of whack here, that is how you know where to turn, where to line up, where to get yourself more connected. That's how you know. I can't tell you how to do it, but you have to feel it in any given moment. You know when you're not really being honest about something, when you're really just beating yourself up way too much, when these little bitty cuts and paper cuts and little bitty things that we do to ourselves, when it's beginning to take hold and affect us. So, the sila, it's fluid. Not some noun, some definitive thing. I'll end with this Sharon Salzberg quote. We'll talk a little bit about what we're going to do. Maybe I'll just talk about it now. So next week, we're going to talk about a summary on this. So we'll have a summary on this, but I also like to talk about the implications. So as you're sitting there, all of this stuff is coming up in your head about your life, how it applies, where it's at, how am I internalizing this, sensing into it? You practice with it. You're going to notice there's an implication of what these Dhamma talks are in our lives. There's an implication to our lives. It's not just, oh, I hear those words, those are good. Right? Those are good. It's not that. There's something that gets stirred up in our lives about these talks. And next week, when we're in our small groups, we could actually talk about the implications of that and what gets stirred up. And then in a couple of weeks, then we'll talk about right conduct and how that looks and how that shows up. How do we actually practice with this virtue? But for now, we just want to take the week and begin to see if we can check into our conduct, check into those four conditions. Because here's the thing about conditioned behavior. When we cultivate each one of those four conditions, we cultivate the chastity, or the, I'm just going to call it integrity, we cultivate calmness, we cultivate this kind of quiet solitude, and we cultivate this extinguishment. The virtue rises out of that. You try to go be virtuous, we're going to trip up all the time. But when we cultivate these other four conditions, then we notice that our behavior becomes more in line with sila, becomes more virtuous. So I'll leave you with this last quote here from Sharon Salzberg. She says, "We can travel a long way in life and do many things, but our deepest happiness is not born from accumulating new experiences. It is born from letting go of what is unnecessary and knowing ourselves to always be at home." That's what you're looking for, a sense of being at home in your own conduct, whether it's skillful or it is not skillful. You learn either way. If it's skillful, you begin to see into the virtue of it. If it's unskillful, then you learn where your values are and how you're slipping away. Whether it's skillful, unskillful, it's irrelevant. You just practice with that internal sense that I'm at home either way. Okay, we'll stop there. Thank you for your kind attention. So sit for a moment. So there might be some questions or comments that anybody has.
Mm-hmm. Because I just think that's just a bad habit. That's the way my brain wants to work, and I'm not going to pay too much attention to it. So it seems, I guess what I'm looking for, the whole reason I'm bringing this up, is I'm looking for a little validation.
No pressure.
Because my bad habit is also saying that's letting you off the hook.
For those of you that didn't hear, she's saying that she has this habit of every time she has these experiences in the present, they seem to trigger some memory of some thing she did before, that some bad thing that she did that she doesn't like, judges herself for it. And so I guess currently it's more like when she hears that, she can sense into it as this is habit of mine. And this is more of a habit. And so she just lets go of those thoughts. just, you know, lets them go. But then, as the mind does in its trickster way, it says, oh, letting go of that is a bad habit. You know, you're not really dealing with it. You should open it up and get in there and investigate it. So I think she said she's looking for some validation. Like, you know, is this good practice? One thing about good practice, not good practice. First of all, I think the practice is fine. I mean, that's what I would do. I would just let go of thoughts, right? But think of practice as a ever-growing turning towards something. It's building up a lot of confidence. So when I first started becoming aware of the irritation, I got to learn how to be with irritation and let go of my judgment that I'm always irritated all the time. So I'm always letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, and not beating myself up because I'm noticing that I'm irritated all the time. You get a little bit further in there, you begin to see that really you could let go of the talking, but something's happening in the body. There's a felt sense that's in the body, and it's not related to all that talking. So eventually, I had to learn to feel what I call irritation. I had to learn to be comfortable with feeling the unpleasantness of always having that tension all around me all the time. As I started feeling into the unpleasantness of it, so even though the irritation would pop up, it's not the irritation and who did what and why am I irritated. I begin to realize as soon as that would pop up, this is the moment to feel into this. Because the reason why this turning towards that feeling into the body is so important is because you don't actually have to let any of that go. There's a letting go that kind of begins to happen as you begin to feel into the difficulty. So for a long time, I had sits and I'd be full of anxiety. And some of you may remember, I used to be like, if you were sitting next to me, I'm so sorry. It's like, I couldn't sit still. So I'm always wiggling and squirming and trying my best to be with this, but it's so uncomfortable. At first, all I could do was to distract myself from the uncomfortability of this anxiety so I could sit. That's all I could do. But as time went on, I could take a little bit of the meditation and try to hold that uncomfortability, try to feel that a little bit, see what that is. And then, you know, distraction, whatever would help me stay in the chair, that's what I would do. So that's what you're doing. You're working with it. The idea of letting it go is fine. It's working. It's helping you. Don't listen to the mind's judgment about what you're doing. But if you feel a sense, your own feeling a sense, not out of obligation, but your own sense of, what is this feeling that keeps showing up? There's words attached, but it's a familiar body felt sense. You may want to just feel that body sense. Without words. Words are really irrelevant. But you might want to feel in the body, where is that reoccurring thing? And not so you can make the unpleasantness go away. I never had to make anxiety go away. It eventually shifted on its own, but it came because I changed my attitude in relationship from it. Do you see? So that's what you're looking for, looking at that. But this letting go, that's totally where you have to start anyway. Good. Yeah.
suspending judgment on the various things that happened in the past or even in the present. I go to, I look for forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from?
That forgiveness? Or that needing to be forgiven?
Yeah, either forgiving the, you know, what happened or needing forgiveness.
So her question is that even when she begins to suspend the words around things, there seems to be this arising need for forgiveness, either for herself or for someone else, for the harm that was done. And where is that? I personally think that forgiveness is a private thing, right? So I always think that forgiveness really is ours. It's our gift that we give ourselves to let go of something and to stop constantly re-engaging with it. So what forgiveness is going to show up like for you is going to come out of the body. And the best way I can describe this has to do with, I felt like I was harmed right before I went on a retreat once. And I felt this deep wound. It was so mad. And it was right before I went on the retreat, so I never could recover from that wound. And so for the first few days of the retreat, I'm just spinning around and around and around, replaying, retalking, saying what I didn't get a chance to say, trying to work it out, crafting this email I'm going to send. And it's like, so this. And I did this under the belief that I was thinking, okay, I'm going to work on it and take care of it, and then I'm going to have a good retreat. And it's not going anywhere. So my teacher said, I was sharing this in my interviews with her. She said, if you're having those reoccurring thoughts, that's something going on in the body. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I know. I can feel it, right? So that's why I'm working it out. I'm working it out, working it out. She's like, if you have those reoccurring thoughts, something's going on in the body. You got to feel it. It's the felt sense. And eventually, I'm like working, mind is working. And I was on a walking and I thought, I wonder if these words are just the mind's trying to articulate what it feels in the body. Like it's not really the words. It's something going on in my body that I haven't just let work its way out of the body. Because every time we go in the body, we bring those words back into play. Because why do I feel anxiety? I have anxiety, and here's the reasons, and blah, blah, blah. So when you get this sense of reoccurring, what I did was I just let go of the words, and I just kept coming back to the body. We do it all the time. We practice with it all the time. We just keep coming back to the breath, in this non-judgmental, pushing way, just keep coming back. And I had this exquisite experience of compassion. I can remember walking down the street going, oh my God, it's so beautiful. And it's mostly because I never let myself actually feel compassion. I only articulate compassion. Like, I'm going to be compassionate. I'm going to say compassionate words, kindness, and be very gentle. But really, I needed to feel it. So this idea, if you keep coming back to the same kind of energy, it generally means there's a sensation in the body that's trying to get out. And the only way we can kind of let it out is we have to stop the story that we have attached to it. So the sensations are not to generate the story. The fact that we keep hearing the same story in our head over and over and over is what tells us there's something in the body that needs to be felt that we're not actually connecting with. So it's just sitting there, letting whatever that felt sense of, you can almost even take the word forgiveness out, because it may not even be forgiveness. Take any kind of words to it and let it be. I thought I was mad. I thought that's what I was so upset, is that I needed to get it out there and say what I should have said. But actually, it was compassion. And so it could very well be that just letting yourself feel the sensations and give yourself time to feel it, that as time goes on, you feel it in a different way. Okay, we'll do one more. You did say that. Just saying.
Mm-hmm. But I also need to protect myself, or that's my idea, or I need to make enough space and room around me to be able to self-support in this kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's where staying connected to the virtue is completely unstuck.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see if I can. Okay, so I'm assuming everybody heard that. If I heard that, was that? But just in case of. She's just saying that she gets stuck in this place when she has her sense of virtue and values, but she's working in like a work environment where you're contained and you have to work with people, and they don't have the same values, and their behavior is far more unskillful and far more harmful. And how do I work with this and not lose it all the time, because I'm working with all this difficulty? I'm assuming that's paraphrasing it.
Yeah, how do I not lose it in turn? I can go home and be with, okay, what all the feelings are that came up. That's not the hard part. The hard part is that in that moment, how do I not let that feeling of forgiveness and compassion and all abandon who I want to be,
Yeah, so how do you hold on to who you want to be and still take care of yourself so you can feel safe in a space where somebody else doesn't have this sort of skillful behavior? Okay. So I'm going to give you that quick and dirty. I never do quick and dirty, though. I've been trying to do quick and dirty. I had that same opinion about defense attorneys, right? I'm a prosecutor. We're upholding the good and just, and we're the right people, and they're the bad people, and they're the problem people. And Rodney gave us an exercise one time that just said, pick a moment in your day and you're going to be quiet. You're not going to say nothing. You're just going to be quiet. So I picked right after I got into a courtroom, because that's when it's all crazy and everybody's, yeah, that's when we all show our true colors. So I'm sitting in this courtroom and I'd be quiet. And then over the course of a week, I realized I didn't have any tension. I didn't have any problems. So when I got back the next week, I'm telling Rodney, I got a problem with this, because it kind of implies, you know, I'm the problem, because we don't have any problems and I don't talk. Like, that's not doable. But actually, what I did was gave myself space to not have to engage. Right? There's a, you're caught. So if you try to say, I'm going to be virtuous, you're right, you're going to have problems. And you're going to have to hold both the times when you are virtuous and when you aren't. You just have to hold that. But what you're trying to cultivate is a sense of quiet that's just your own intent. So even if you see some unskillful behavior, I'm not going to say that. That's your business. I remember when I was not skillful. You know, we haven't always been on the practice. I haven't always been on the path. So I remember that. Try to work on extinguishing my judgment. Just let it go. If it's judgment, stop judging. There's no other way around it. Work on my own sense of calmness around whatever difficulties is showing up and my own sense of personal integrity. So it's working on, it's like instead of working on trying to hold your value, your virtue, that is anger. That's my anger. That's irrelevant. By the time you get to that, you're already past. What you have to work on is the judgment. The judgment around this person and these people is so thick that you are constantly, before you even see them, you've already judged them. And that's what I did when I was quiet in that room. So it's really just, not just intellectually saying, I know that's a judgment, I need to let it go. No, it is, in the actuality, what would happen if you let go of the judgment? What would happen if you went to work for an entire week and you actually let go of whether or not someone's behavior is skillful or not? And just let them be however they are. It's not you. And let them be. And you just have to try it and see what happens so you can see what else to do. But you can come up and we can talk afterwards if you want to, but I have to stop now because I have to do some announcements.